Monster Man, special episode, Monstera Deliciosa. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Ted. If you'd like to be like Ted and get your own special episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to the chance to choose a topic for an episode, you'll also get access to the rewards for all other levels, including every episode of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Ted, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy the show. Also, it's time to welcome a new Patreon backer. Yes, this is someone who's gone over to the aforementioned patreon.com/monsterman, and they have pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. So thank you very much to returning patron Adam Buxton. Your support means a lot to me. Now, Ted has chosen a somewhat unorthodox topic for this episode, which will hardly surprise those of you who know him. Ted asked me to do something with a plant, not a flesh-eating plant, not a poisonous plant, not a particularly valuable plant, just a plant. But as I always say when it comes to special episodes, I just drive the cab, you decide the destination. So, a plant it will be. Specifically, the plant that Ted has asked me to talk about is the Monstera plant. Now, I have decided to treat this as a little challenge. I'm not exactly doing it live. As I am speaking to you now, I know what I'm going to say. But the way I did this is that I just sat down and started writing and saw what came out. When I first set pen to paper, or more accurately, finger to keyboard, I had no idea what was going to go into this episode. So this is not quite the first draft, because obviously I've had a little time to think about it ever since I finished it. This is sort of like a first and a half draft of turning the Monstera plant into an actual monster. So let's start by taking a look at the plant itself. The reason that Ted chose this plant, I think, is basically that its genus name is Monstera. And it's not a word that sounds like monster by coincidence. It is called the monster plant. Now, that's a little odd because it is not particularly monstrous. It is a genus of flowering plants, mainly found in tropical regions, originally in kind of Central America and the Caribbean, I think, and it is also today an intrusive species in other tropical biomes. So, for instance, I believe they are intrusive in Hawaii. As far as I can tell, the plant was named Monstera only because of the unusual shape of its leaves. And if you look at an image of some Monstera leaves, they are kind of odd. They have holes in them, but sort of regular holes, not as though they had been gnawed on, but as though they were built into the structure of the plant, which, of course, they are. This occurs in the leaves of certain plant species, and it is called being fenestrated, literally windowed. And these rows of holes typically going down either side of the spine of the leaf. They do look quite strange, I suppose, and Europeans encountering them for the first time won't have seen anything very similar to them, I wouldn't think. I mean, I'm not a historical botanist, but they seem to have thought that it was strange because that's why they gave the plants the name Monstera. Now, I don't know how much this scientific name is used. They're also sometimes called things like Swiss cheese plants. Several of the different colloquial names for the plant involve references to other things that have holes in them. So the fenestrations do seem to have been what caught the eye of botanists. The purpose of the fenestrations is simple enough. Partly they are a structural feature to help the leaves get big, and Monstera leaves can be very large. They can be something like 90 centimeters long. That's about 3 feet for my imperial listeners. And in some rare cases, there's a Monstera gigas, you know, giant monster. They have leaves that are up to 300 centimeters long, approximately 10 feet. And then they can be as wide as 75 centimeters, which is about 2.5 feet. So that's a lot. And these holes in the leaf blade essentially allow them to spread over a greater area. Now, having a larger leaf can be advantageous for sunlight collection even if you aren't increasing the overall surface area of the leaf. So obviously those holes in the leaf, they're not getting more sunlight, but what they're doing is meaning that the leaf is in a wider range of places, so it's getting sunlight at more times of the day. That's my understanding anyway, particularly when you consider that these often grow in environments where there's a lot of tree canopy cover. That's another reason that the holes may exist, is that they allow leaves on lower levels to be getting sunlight as well. So reasonable planty kind of explanations, but they do look peculiar, and they do have that like virtue of unfamiliarity. I mean, they would if there weren't relatively common houseplants in the Monstera genus, but I do think that if I was trying to create a fantasy or particularly kind of science fiction-y environment and I wanted it to look natural but also very clearly not European, I might throw in some wide-leaved fenestrated Monstera plants. Now, that's all well and good, but this isn't as useful to the tabletop gamer as it might be, because, of course, we're talking about primarily visual qualities. And communicating incidental visual qualities in role-playing games is tricky. It requires a certain judicious approach, because most of the time, if you tell players that there are little holes in the leaves, they're going to react like it's a clue rather than a detail that it's just meant to establish that they're not in Kansas. It's very difficult to include a small detail in a verbal description without either going overboard and describing everything, or making players start looking for the leaf goblins. I guess if you're one of those GMs who uses a Pinterest mood board or similar, you could throw an image on there. These are the sorts of things that you'll see when you're deep in the steaming jungles of the Isle of Dread. But this is a problem that we're going to run into later on as well, because there are some other distinctive visual qualities of the particular species of the genus Monstera that I want to talk about. This is, of course, Monstera deliciosa, the delicious monster. It's a great name, and the plant earns it by bearing fruit. Now, I've never seen monster fruit in a market, but perhaps I am an unambitious cook. Supposedly, the fruit tastes like a cross between a peach and a pineapple, which sounds good at least. This sort of similarity of the flavor to other fruit can also sometimes earn it the nickname the fruit salad plant. And the fruit, like the leaves, is very visually interesting. It looks really strange, especially when it's unripe. If you look up an image of Monstera deliciosa fruit, you'll see what I mean. It's quite large, it's longish, it's sort of shaped like an ear of corn in that it narrows to a point, but kind of a blunt point. When it's unripe, its surface is covered with scales, a bit like a pineapple, but not really pointy. And they are a sort of elongated hexagonal shape. So it really does look very alien. If I had a couple of Monstera deliciosa fruits and they were unripe, I would put them in a basket of food being carried by a colorful bystander in a Star Wars scene setting kind of shot. You know what I mean? That's the sort of thing I'm talking about. It's clearly natural, but it's also very unfamiliar. The thing that it reminds you of most, I guess, is a pineapple. But it's not very similar, or like a pine cone, I guess. And when it ripens, the scales come off. Some other odd things about this plant include that the fruit takes over a year to ripen, which is a long time, and you can't really eat it early because the unripe fruit contains these crystalline structures. I couldn't tell you what these are, but they're called raphides and tricosclerides, and they are calcium oxalate structures. And when the fruit is not ripe, they can cause irritation in the mouth if you eat them. And apparently have a very strong odor when they ripen, a bit like, so the Monstera are members of the arum family, the Araceae, and I guess is it the Titan arum that is the really smelly corpse plant? So I guess there's a similarity there, although apparently the scent of the ripening fruit is very pleasant. Oh, also, you shouldn't have this plant if you are a pet owner, like a cat or dog owner, because the plant in general is toxic to them. So the plant's a little dangerous. I don't think that's why it's monstrous, though. Well, in fact, I know that it's not. It is cultivated, but there's some reasons not to cultivate it, I guess, including it's relatively sensitive to changes in temperature, especially it cannot get too cold. And, of course, the fruit takes a really long time to ripen. But once it does ripen, as I said, the scales fall off, the fruit can be harvested, processed, rinsing away any residual fibers, and served. So what have we got to work with here? A few things. First, the fruit has an unusual appearance. It's got quite a long life cycle. It changes a lot over its life cycle, which is true of most fruits, I suppose. But the scales coming away thing is really pretty dramatic. Like, if you look at an unripe and a ripe fruit, they look really different. So there's something there, maybe, and of course it's dangerous while it's unripe. This is really starting to sound like an ecological monster. I usually don't do monsters that are this rooted, no pun intended, in ecology, just because that's not my background. But I think in this case we might have to. We start with that name, Monstera deliciosa, delicious monster. So this obviously evokes that dungeon meshy or delicious in dungeon episode we did a while back, talking about the idea of monsters you can cook and eat, and specifically the idea of monsters as a delicacy. And I think there's something to the idea of having a monster that you have to be patient with if you want to get the reward from it. If this were an episode of Delicious in Dungeon, that's what Senshi would be explaining when they do the serving shot. So we have a plant monster, we have a monster that changes as it matures. So maybe the monster's behavior, maybe its kind of patterns are different at different points in its life cycle. So when the monster is young, that is when it's unripe, it's dangerous and aggressive, but then when it's ripe, it's delicious. So I was reading an article about the Monstera deliciosa in Gardener's World. This is what you've done to me, Ted, Gardener's World. And it said that the plant was needy, which I think just means that it needs to be watered quite regularly, and it's sensitive to its environment, like the fluctuations in temperature thing that I mentioned. But I like the idea of the plant as needy. It needs a lot of nutrients from the soil and water. Maybe that's why our plant monster is motile. It uses up the resources in one area, and then it has to move to another. And what it really wants is for, insofar as it wants anything, is for its heirs, its offspring, to be born in a nutrient-rich area, which of course is why it has the fruit. Fruit are part of a plant's reproductive strategy. Animals eat the fruit, they go to a different place, they leave their droppings, the droppings contain the seeds, and that both spreads the plant's genetic line beyond a single restricted area and also provides the seed with a nutrient-rich environment to grow in. Now, this doesn't come up as much with humans because we often don't eat the seeds of a fruit, like most people don't eat apple cores or whatever. Or we often breed varieties of the plant that don't have seeds, like in the case of bananas. Those little sort of dots inside a banana are where its seeds once were. But most animals, obviously, will just scoff the lot. So we said that the plant has to be dangerous when it's unripe. So let's say that during its juvenile motile stage, the plant monster is aggressive and dangerous. It starts out as a little shoot, and that doesn't move. That's sessile. And then when it becomes a juvenile, when the fruit appears, but it's not yet ripe, it becomes ambulatory, and there's some competition here, right? If it were to be eaten or otherwise damaged, that's curtains for the whole reproductive strategy, so obviously it's able to fight. And also, since they have to seek out nutrient-rich areas, presumably this would put them in competition with other plant creatures who are seeking out the same areas, maybe even each other. So they might fight over resources. We might be able to make a weapon out of the spine-like irritants. Maybe it can spit them somehow, project them, or it whips you with one of its branches. It can kind of cause a rash. But I think, honestly, it's probably just kind of a big thorny plant creature that can give you a biff. If it's sensitive to changes in temperature, again, it's not so much that it worries about getting killed, but that it worries about its fruit not being eaten because it's not going to be able to reproduce. So, if it's sensitive to increased heat or cold, that might increase the chance that the fruit would not survive, something like that. We might make it vulnerable to fire or cold damage. I'm tempted to make it cold damage, a frost that kills the oranges or whatever, just because fire damage seems like the more obvious choice for a creature that's made out of wood. But if this thing is guzzling up water everywhere it goes, then, it might not be that flammable. Now, this is a very high cost strategy. That's a problem that we'll come back to, but this monster is expending a lot of energy, which means it's got to get a lot of energy somewhere, which plants in general don't. We don't have to be too specific about how this works. Now, in addition to this being a very high-cost reproductive strategy, which we'll return to later, the monster seems like kind of a dangerous nuisance. So in order to explain why they're still around, I think we have to suggest that there's something extremely valuable about these fruit. either they're so incredibly delicious that elites will pay a high price for them, or they have some other benefit. They have magical qualities, they have healing properties, something like that. The elites paying high prices thing might actually make sense, because the whole story of how you had to pay a party of adventurers to go out and collect the fruit from the trees or what have you, and they're only harvestable in this one window, and, you know, people live their lives on traditional ambulatory delicious monster farms or whatever, it's got a story to it, which is a quality that people like in their luxury goods. Now, I think a lot of us assume that there is like a pretty clear demarcation between the like natural world and the world of civilization, between hunter-gatherer and agrarian societies, and so on. And this is not to say that there are not important differences, but also there are some big areas of overlap. One of those areas is in the management of these kinds of natural resources. So hunter-gatherers don't just move through the landscape consuming resources and moving on. They often actively manage those resources. So for example, they might plant more trees when they cut some down, or make sure not to take all of a particular fruit so that the plants can continue to reproduce, or whatever, right? They might clear away species that are encroaching on a particular grove. They might make sure not to overhunt herds that they're going to want to hunt again next year. Things like that. This is my understanding. I'm not a prehistorian, but I believe that prehistoric societies like this practiced some kinds of active conservation strategies. So we can imagine that there might be people who do the same with these plant creatures. They herd them. They try to guide them toward nutrient-rich areas, maybe even including nutrient-rich areas owned by people they don't like. And then they wait until they ripen and swoop in and harvest them. Does the plant become sessile again at the end of its life cycle? That's a question. Does it wander, wander, wander until it finally takes root when the fruits ripen? I mean, I don't know why it would, but also I don't know where it'd be going. It could be fun if the creatures following the plant weren't just other people, but say, goblins or other characters that could be difficult to reason with or even threaten. So they follow the plant monsters around, they herd them gently away from goblin encampments toward human farms or whatever, until finally they see that they're just about ripe and they swoop in with their sickles, cut off all the fruit, and then hightail it before a bunch of fruit hunters turn up to take all the delicacies to the caliph to be used to impress ambassadors or whatever. These goblin herding parties could use the plant's temperature sensitivity to move them, so maybe they... Well, they probably don't have a good way to make it cold. They got a great way to make it hot, which is starting fires. Something goblins are seldom averse to doing, right? And maybe they have got some way to make it cold. Maybe they can even do things like using shade to cool off certain areas so that the plants will not be interested in going into them. Maybe they've got big baskets full of ice covered in sawdust, you know. It could also be fun if the locals in a certain area, right, the people that harvest the plant monster, are the only ones who know the trick of making the fruit safe to eat. Or maybe not the only ones, but certainly, like, if you're an outsider and you just think, oh, look at this delicious fruit, you might not know that you need to, like, wash it in lemon juice to remove the remaining fibers. And so when you eat it, you get a tummy ache. Or instead of getting a tummy ache, maybe what the locals know how to do is prevent the seeds from sprouting. So the locals harvest a bunch of delicious monster fruit, and they remove the seeds from the flesh, they put a small number aside, and then they somehow prevent the rest from sprouting by, like, heating them and eating them like popcorn. Then they take the remaining viable seeds and they plant them in a mid-in or some other kind of fertilized patch, so they're keeping a manageable number of the plant monsters in the environment and assuring that they've got enough seeds for future years' harvests. And that's all well and good. Like, they've got a whole system worked out, and that works great until the caliph decides he wants to build a road through the woods and his soldiers start hunting down the plant monsters because they're attacking the road workers. Now, they're only attacking the road workers because the road workers are trying to, like, pave over those highly nutritious areas of soil that they need in order to keep their life cycle going. And now your villagers aren't going to have any hyper-nutritious fruit come harvest time. And of course, you could have an outsider who doesn't know how to deal with the seeds come and eat one of the fruit and then go back to their town where they, you know, deposit the seed and forget about it because they only saw the tree in its mature phase. Then comes springtime, you've got immature plant monsters rampaging around the sewers. Nobody wants that. In addition to a delicious monster, this could be a good academic study of monsters as well. Like, this seems like something the Department of Monsterology would send you off to go recover. I also feel like this could be a dark sun creature. You'd need to take some of the tropical jungleness of it. I mean, there are tropical jungles in dark sun, having said that, so maybe you wouldn't. But instead of moving because it's so nutrient hungry, we could say that it moves around in order to sort of suck up tiny amounts of moisture and nutrients over a wide range. And then its broad leaves could almost be like sails as it blows across the sand, or it could roll like a tumbleweed. And then after its very long ripening cycle, very long, because of course these resources are available only in very small amounts, it would concentrate all the moisture and nutrition that it had collected in the fruit. I think that's the kind of thing you could have in Dark Sun. In fact, if you told me it already was or something not unlike it, I would believe you. And if you told me I had covered it myself, I would believe you. That's not impossible. Now, as I said before, on a strictly energy management view, this probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but never mind that. As we established, I think, a number of times in Dark Sun, we don't really have to have a rigorously simulated ecology. We have to nod at the concepts of ecology. We have to make people think about these types of ideas without necessarily advancing a detailed argument that people could critique or find fault with. And I don't mean that in terms of like we're trying to protect ourselves from criticism, but that we're trying to protect the player or the reader from not the loss of suspension of disbelief. That's a whole different question and one that I'm not sure even really applies. But if you are enjoying thinking about something in ecological terms and then the ecological aesthetic collapses from the monster, then you're not enjoying that part of it anymore. And that's the important thing. But so yeah, I think there's a number of possible applications for the delicious monster in your fantasy role-playing games. And I have taken an ordinary fruit tree slash houseplant and turned it into a fun monster. And so I feel like my work here is done and that is all the time I have to talk about Monstera plants for today. So Ted, thank you very much, as always, for your continued support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Ted and get your own special episode, don't forget that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're going to be talking about the monsters used to scare small children. We're going to be talking about boogeymen, so I hope that you will join me then, right here, on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.